Hello and welcome to Sprogcast, a radio show all about pregnancy, birth and early parenthood, hosted by Karen Hall and Mark Harris. Welcome to episode 8 of Sprogcast, a podcast about pregnancy, birth and early parenthood. Sprogcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Pinter & Martin, an independent publishing company specialising in pregnancy, birth and parenting, psychology, nutrition and yoga at pinterandmartin.com. Today's episode is all about diversity with interviews, a report from our strident student midwife at the Royal College of Midwives Conference, news, views and some endorsements. We also want to mention all the lovely new branding created for us by Nick Hilditch. I'm Karen Hall.
And I'm Mark Harris. Coming up today, we've got some interviews that begin to explore the experience of the LGBTQI community when it comes to birth and birthing. So we did a quick survey on Twitter asking who your midwifery heroes are. And we got a lot of lovely answers, including Sheila Byron, a hero of mine, it has to be said, who just said, women are her heroes. Now, I get that. Come and talk to us on facebook.com/progcast. It's not progcast, actually. It's no, sprogcast. It's we're both having trouble with sprogcast today.
We're both having trouble with words today. Let's
we
face
are.
It.
I get your teeth in, Karen. Right. Now, come and talk to us on facebook.com/sprogcast or Twitter at sprogcast. You know, we want to know what you want us to talk about, who you want us to talk to.
I'm hoping that we can speak to somebody from the Infant Sleep Information Source and the Durham Sleep Lab for the next episode.
You know, in a way, when we were talking about sleep earlier, Karen, off air, you were talking about various insights that you have around sleep. And it kind of reminded me of potty training. You know, the hypothalamus in a child isn't really developed enough until around about 18 months for a child to have, you know, voluntary control over their defecation and urination.
Right.
So, you know, so all those people that have potty trained their child under a year, they haven't potty trained their child. They trained themselves to read signals.
I read a really lovely article once about the culture where it was standard practice not to use nappies. And an interviewer saying to a mother, well, how do you know when your baby wants to use the toilet? And her just looking at the interviewer and saying, well, how do you know when you want to use the toilet? As if, you know, it was she was so in tune with her baby.
Right.
That there was no question of kind of watching for signals or anything like that. She just knew.
All of that stuff's going on at a deeply unconscious level, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, that ability to pick up cues is happening outside of awareness. Because if you were thinking about that, your conscious mind wouldn't have enough space to think about your daily life.
But how alien is that to UK mothers?
Completely. I mean, obviously I've got six children and we were very laid back parents. And we didn't make an issue out of anything, whether it was eating or sleeping. In fact, my oldest son, you know, wet his bed till he was 12. None of his friends follow this.
I was going to say, he'll be really thankful you just broadcast that to 221 people.
We made no issue of his bed wetting. We didn't make him strip the bed. We didn't make it into something he was doing wrong. We didn't pressure him or force him. And eventually it just stopped.
Yeah.
But without any finger pointing, name calling. And I know we don't do that as parents actively, but sometimes I think we can allow our own frustration and mood to affect our parenting style, you know.
However laid back you feel you are, however kind of aligned with attachment principles and all of that, you know, there are moments of disappointment that you do let show.
Without a doubt. I mean, without a doubt. And that's, again, happening at a deeply unconscious level. You know, children are perfect modellers of their environment.
Mm.
And they're taking on board at deeply unconscious levels our attitudes and our motivations. And for me, when I do get into irritation, when I do notice that my parenting style is flowing from me wanting to do something and him not wanting to do something, as soon as I realise it, I say sorry.
Yeah.
I say, look, man, that was all about me, and I'm really sorry.
And I think that's a really important part of parenting, because we're not going to get it right all the time. We're not supposed to get it right all the time. But how would our children learn about just general humanity if we were perfect?
Yeah.
But the fact that we apologise and put things right is really useful.
Without a doubt. And what it does, I think, one of the things it does is it shifts responsibility for my emotions, you know, because a child can take on my emotions and confuse them for disapproval, for you're not doing the right thing, inverted commas, you're bad, all of those kind of ways of thinking about things. But when I take responsibility for my irritation, you know, my mild anger and all that kind of stuff, it places the responsibility where it should be, with me.
Hmm.
It reminds me of that little boy who was standing at the table and wouldn't sit down. And his dad said, sit down, sit down, sit down. Eventually, and he sat down, bolt upright in his body. And he looked at his dad and he said, I'm sat down, but I'm stood up inside.
Good. I like the free thinking.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's very frustrating as a parent to have a free-thinking, independently minded child.
Not just frustrating, but I think it breeds a bit of insecurity. You see, I notice with my grandchildren, I've got six grandchildren, I thoroughly immerse myself in their freedom of thinking, their just willingness to explore and experience their environment. And then I notice that I'm not making their behaviour mean anything about me. When I was parenting my own, I would watch their behaviour and I was making their behaviour mean something about me and my parenting.
Right.
So they would behave a certain way in public, which my grandchildren can do it, and it's delightful and the sign of a burgeoning intelligence. My own children did it. I used to think, oh, God, what's that going to say about me as a parent? What are people going to think?
Yes, I can absolutely understand that. And you sometimes you see it absolutely overtly with parents who are speaking to their child in public in a loud, clear voice that they know other people will hear. And I've done it myself. This is quite interesting in terms of looking at that study that you put on Facebook about children yeah. living with female same-sex couples have 40% more focused time with their parents, because that's about kind of fathers with female partners and women in same-sex relations and how much time they're likely to spend with their child and engaged in child-focused activities.
As I read the article, it became less a comment on the experience of same-sex partners in the birth world or in the parenting world, and it became more a differentiation between the amount of time that male partners spend with their children anyway. I think the survey looked at 40,000 parents' experiences. 55 of those couples were in same-sex relationships. So it's quite a small portion.
A bit small to draw conclusions from.
I mean, it's drawing conclusions in the bigger context of the study.
Yeah.
So it's highlighting the 55 because those 55 couples were two women. The women are spending something like 40% more time with their children than the fathers are.
Yeah.
Men tend to spend half their time actively with their children than the mother does. And the study does go on to explain that a lot of the couples were in fairly, inverted commas, traditional relationships where the men were the major wage earners. So as a study, you know, it's interesting.
It's really a good social comment about parenting roles in general. In a traditional family, probably women do spend more time focused. I mean, just looking at our family, I'm pretty sort of feminist person, and yet still, I'm the one with the part-time job, and I'm the one doing the school pickup and spending that time after school. So there just physically is that extra number of hours for me to spend with my child.
Exactly, because the study does, when it talks about active face-to-face time with children, it is including appointments at hospital, it is including bathing, it's including reading with the child, focused playing with the child. It's very interesting. I was a bit disappointed by the study because I wanted to know more about same-sex parenting when there's two men doing that.
They had very little data on that, didn't they?
Yeah. This is one of the reasons why we're focusing on the LGBTQI community.
Well, that came out of a comment on Twitter. I noticed somebody saying there are all these issues within our community and somebody should be raising them. And I said, okay, here we go. We've got a podcast. Granted, it's not got a massive circulation, but if you want to talk to us, please do.
Okay, I'd like to introduce Amy Hambling. She's a friend of mine. She's a doula, She works in birth as well as postnatal. A lot of her work at the moment is postnatal. She has understanding and experience within the LGBT plus community.
We apologise for the sound quality on this interview. We had quite a few technical hitches and we've done our best with it. But if you find it unlistenable, the interview is about 29 minutes long. Please just skip forward to the rest of the podcast. It's really interesting stuff. Here's Amy Hamblin.
So, I tell you what, when we decided on Sprogcast that we were going to do an episode on the experience of people in the LGBTQI community, we had loads of feedback saying, what's the Q and the I? This is new to me. God, what? I've just got comfortable with LGBT. And I was in a gay bookshop in London, looking at what was on the shelves, and I spoke to a gay man, and I said to him about LGBTQI, and he kind of huffed frustratedly, and he said, he was an older man, and he said, yeah, I prefer LGBT plus. When are we going to stop adding all these letters? Yeah. And I explored with him Q and I. Can you say more about LGBTQ and I?
Lesbian, gay, bi.
Yeah.
Trans.
Yeah, got that.
Questioning.
Right.
Intersex.
All right. Or some people have said to me, questioning or queer, depending on...
Yeah, I think questioning is a newer one. I historically would have said queer, and I think queer is now sometimes questioning.
Well, I'm intrigued with the history of queer. As a heterosexual man, I would never use the word queer. And the man in the bookshop said, no, you wouldn't, unless you were talking about queer research and he kind of empathised with that. He said it's not a word that a heterosexual man could use.
Yeah, I think that's fair, isn't it? My understanding, which may be limited, is that it was just a reappropriation of a word that had been derogatory. Brilliant. Within the community.
Brilliant.
So you call me queer as a put down, and I will call myself queer as a flag waving.
Questioning. So forgive my naivety and my lack of information. I say that straight up front. So I have gay friends, obviously, and I've had some gay friends who have quite strong views about bisexual.
Yes.
That they would say questioning and bisexual are the same.
As a bisexual, I would say that's not the truth. I liked it how you said that. My friend says.
Yeah, of course. How do you? You don't have to respond to that.
So I think bisexual people do end up kind of having a kind of a lot of fear projected onto them by heterosexuals and people who would call themselves gay.
Right.
Kind of fear around, if you're with me, are you going to want to be with someone that is different to me? Will I satisfy you?
Right.
Because you are not just interested in attracted to people of a certain genital configuration. But my experience of talking to people who feel comfortable with the label bisexual is that they say they fall in love with people.
Right.
It's about the person. It doesn't matter what their body type is.
Because when I think about my own sexuality, I start thinking, the choices that I feel come up for me spontaneously, and if you ask me when did I decide my sexuality, that's a ridiculous question to me, and I'm guessing that's a ridiculous question to a person who would consider themselves gay.
Mm-hmm.
That there wasn't a component within that felt like choice.
Decision, no.
Yeah, yeah.
There is some research that suggests, going to a gender difference, that, my understanding of this would be to do with the way gender is culturally constructed.
Yes.
Whereby it is somewhat easier for women to kind of move along the gay heterosexual spectrum
yes
than for men.
Are you at this point in our conversation? Could you give us a bit of a bio?
So I had my daughter, who is now six, with woman partner. We explored in the kind of preparation to being pregnant, lots of different options in terms of how we might go about making a family. And in the end, we decided what was best for us was to do that through the kind of formal channel of a clinic with an anonymous donor. But we felt lucky in that the law had changed fairly recently before we conceived our daughter, that meant that all donors would be available and contactable when the donor children became adults.
Right.
That was important for us.
So the law changed so that the father of the baby knows when he's donating that in the future he could be contacted by the child.
Okay, so...
is that right?
We wouldn't ever use the word father.
Oh, thank you, sorry.
So, because father is a social construct, part.
Okay, now I get that. Forgive me.
So, we would say the donor.
Yeah.
And the child needs to be an adult. Legally an adult before they could have contact. So the man or woman who was donating would have no legal rights or responsibilities to the child.
Right.
So there's protection for the person donating, because there could never be a case in this situation where the parents of the child or the child themselves could ask for maintenance money. So then he would never be the father.
And that's the way the law works now.
The way the law works now in this country. But there are women, both heterosexual straight women who are single, and heterosexual couples and gay couples who have fertility treatment outside of the UK where that is not the case. So they come back to this country and there isn't the same amount of information about the donor, and there isn't the opportunity for the child to have contact with the donor when they become an adult.
Right.
Also in this country, donor children at 16 can know their donor siblings. Men can donate to up to 10 families. So potentially there's quite a multiple of siblings that could...
come and find them.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. And apparently my understanding is that children are more interested to find their siblings than the donor.
When the child becomes 18, he doesn't have any right to find the child, but the child has a right to find him.
That's correct.
And that makes some sense to me.
Yeah. And the reason why the law protects, has that 16 thing, is to stop siblings marrying each other.
Got that. That sounds sensible.
Obviously that isn't the only way that two women in a relationship might go about.
Okay. Are you comfortable pregnant. Saying more about that?
Well, for example, that you could travel to another country.
Right.
And have a kind of different system. And there are lots of couples that may think about co-parenting.
Yes.
With friends. Interestingly, there was debate around whether it would be made law for it to be put on children's birth certificates, whether they were donor conceived.
Right.
To protect the right of the child to know that. In a situation where you've got two women in a relationship making a family, it will be pretty obvious to the child growing up that they're in a kind of different context. Other families that they come into contact with.
Yeah.
So it's been my experience that in that kind of situation, that families, gay families, find it pretty easy to talk to their children about how they were conceived.
Of course.
But I think sometimes I know of single straight women and straight couples who really much more struggle around how do we have the conversation about your conception with their child.
I understand that.
And I think because obviously originally fertility treatment primarily occurred to assist straight couples.
Of course, yeah.
And what happened was that people were advised not to tell their children. You know, these donor-conceived children grew up and most of the time eventually found out because secrets have a tendency to kind of out in families.
And they wouldn't have any medical history beyond, they wouldn't have that family-based medical history of the man's side.
Or if it was an egg donor, the woman's side.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, forgive me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so, and I think, so there was a kind of two different components, that, like in terms of your genetic makeup and that kind of how that impacts on your health, and that's something to consider. And then also you just in terms of the kind of psychological dynamic of being in a family where there is a kind of secret
without a doubt, yeah,
it's tricky. And what happened and why the law changed was that there was lots of research done which showed that the younger that children, it was talked about and normalized, and that the less kind of negative impact it had on their lives.
Yeah.
So this would be from single straight women, for straight couples, and for families within.
And that research has influenced the experience of adopted children too.
Well, I think they're very linked.
Yeah. So my adopted son has a storybook that's age appropriate that teaches him about his heritage and his history inside his biological family. So that he grows up with those referencing knowings.
Yeah. So
there's nothing there that will surprise him as he gets older.
As a parent, I was very aware of that, and I wanted to start having those conversations with our daughter really young. And she was quite verbal, quite young, so like around 1.5, she was pretty verbal. She clearly demonstrated to me that she understood that she had two mummies, and that was different.
Yes.
We were watching a Sesame Street video about potty training.
Yes.
And she said, Elmo has daddy, Lulu has two mummies.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, and I thought, wow, she's really worked that out as something that is different, and it was okay for her.
Right. Did you consider a donor that you knew?
Yes, we did. We did have one attempt at conceiving with our friend.
Right.
Which was a very funny sort of comedy of errors.
Right. Okay. I don't know how much to explore there or not.
So kind of everyone makes a turkey based a joke.
Yes.
But actually, I mean, no one really has that much semen or sperm. A syringe is sufficient.
Hey. I'm not saying nothing. God, I don't know whether to. So it's as straightforward if you're going down that road, you know, a syringe.
It's probably easier, really, in terms of the practicalities of the conception. In terms of straightforward, in terms of your, how you then work out your family dynamic and what your family looks like, that's a different question. I would say going to a clinic in a very medicalized way and kind of having a stranger do a kind of very medical process to you, this may well lead us nicely onto birth, isn't that fun. You chart your cycle.
Yeah.
You wait for the ovulation.
Yeah.
You go to the clinic The difference there is they clean they separate the sperm from the semen, and they open your cervix, which is quite painful. So it's put directly past your cervix.
Yeah, it's inseminated beyond the cervix.
Yeah.
And that obviously involves dilatation of the cervix, which I can imagine is a bit very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So if you were going to conceive at home with a known donor, you would just use a syringe straight into the vagina.
Yeah, so it's less likely to be effective.
Apparently, the success rates for IUI and sex are the same.
Oh, really?
So if you're a woman and you don't have fertility issue, you will, with IUI, it will take 3 goes, they say.
Right.
Okay. On average, 3 goes to get pregnant, which is what they think and is a rough time, an average time for a man and a woman to get pregnant with no fertility issues.
Right.
So if you were a lesbian couple and you wanted, or if you were a lesbian couple and you wanted to make a family with a known donor, there are kind of ways that you can protect what you're doing. One thing would be to have a civil partnership or marriage, in which case both the mothers will go on the birth certificate.
Right.
You could use a clinic with a known donor, in which case there's a kind of extra layer of kind of administrative
and legal
protection,
advice,
if you like, there. The most protective way would be to be in a civil partnership or marriage.
Right. It does raise even more questions about cultural influences upon definition, doesn't it? You know, that you have more rights when you're married or in a civil partnership. It gives the state quite a lot of control that it shouldn't have.
So that was the conception.
Cool. And how did you decide which one of you would carry the baby?
In our case, it wasn't really a decision, going back to our conversation earlier about how much do we decide things.
Yeah.
Because I always wanted to be pregnant, and my partner didn't ever want to be. But that isn't the case for all lesbian couples, obviously. Sometimes I know of couples where factors like age have come into it.
Yes.
Where both the people in the couple are kind of interested in carrying the baby, being the tummy mummy.
Yes.
And they may take it in turns.
Yes.
I've known of where couples have tried with maybe the slightly older one, it hasn't worked, the younger one's tried and it's worked, or vice versa.
Yeah.
I guess each couple will have a different kind of story around how that works and what is important to them.
To them, yeah. It's going to be very individual, isn't it?
Mm.
Can you say a little bit about your experience of UK birth culture in terms of the NHS as you were experiencing your pregnancy together?
Well, so I think that we had some kind of fears around how would our relationship be received within that context.
Yeah.
And I certainly went to my midwifery booking appointment feeling quite like, I'm just going to put this on the table, and a little bit defensive, and what are you going to do with this?
Did it feel like coming out again?
It felt like coming out again, and it felt quite scary, and I felt quite vulnerable doing it. And the midwife who booked me was very kind.
Yeah.
And actually was very receptive, and it was actually absolutely fine. I think in all my antenatal appointments, it was never really an issue. It was never raised again.
Right.
You know, that I guess in most antenatal appointments, they're fairly quick because they're kind of doing, you know, if your pregnancy is trotting along absolutely fine and you're not creating any flags around blood pressure there's not a lot of discussion room for the wider context in which the pregnancy is happening within a kind of low risk.
No, I get it. But what about the parts of the booking that ask for the medical history of the donor?
So that wasn't asked. So she very kindly put on the, was really comfortable. She crossed out father. She wrote mother.
Brilliant.
And she put in my partner's details.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the kind of concerns around, you know, kind of genetic stuff.
Yeah.
It was just kind of left as a bit of a blank, and no one really worried about it.
When you go down the unknown donor route, does the service offer you information about the genetic history of the donor?
No, not beyond blood type. Okay. But it's very hard to become a donor.
Right.
You're very medically screened. You can't donate if you're colourblind.
Wow.
Which you would think as a sort of genetic impairment, it was fairly low risk. Also, interestingly, they do not accept men's sperm donors who are under 5'8". Because...
What?
Because women don't choose them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
It's another thing that's maybe linked to our bio-evolutionary adaptive choice, you know, that we think are choices, but are rooted probably in stuff that's in the amygdala and the limbic system.
So when you're going through the kind of criteria, actually height
is a
priority.
Size does matter.
Wouldn't it
be a sensible idea for that some of that genetic history to be made available to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess there is scope for that, because certainly as my child has got older, medical professionals do ask, you know, is there a history of diabetes?
Heart disease.
Yeah, you know, lots of different things within the family, and I can only answer from my family.
Right. And your assumption that the medical screening is really good around donors. So
exactly.
They're definitely not going to be colourblind or short.
Yeah.
I think we'd be naive. You know, sometimes in antenatal classes, I get asked by women, are all midwives kind? And I always say, where do you work? And one woman said, Asda. I said, is everyone you work with kind? And they went, no. Oh, I see what you mean. That midwives are a cross-section of the normal population. And we would be naive to imagine there is not prejudice amongst midwives against the gay community. And it sounds to me like you didn't experience any, even through the birth either.
Running up to the birth, we were aware and were anxious around going into the hospital to have the baby and coming out again with this new set of birth people. We had done some antenatal classes, so we understood the role of oxytocin.
Yeah.
My partner had said that she would feel really uncomfortable being very physically affectionate in such a public space. And we were kind of aware of that going into it.
There was some fear about other people's responses to your intimacy.
Yeah, so we'd done kind of one of the hypnobirthing kind of preparations. So, you know, there's a lot of information about how kind of the connection between sex and birth and oxytocin release and feeling supported. And, you know, we were kind of felt like that was going to be difficult, even more difficult within that context for us as a gay couple. There's going to be a lot of coming out over and over and over and over again. One thing that I did kind of think about was important going back to the kind of antenatal period. So when we were doing our kind of birth prep stuff in a group context with a birth worker, doula and hypnobirthing teacher, she actually did really struggle with the fact that we were two women. She, at the start of the weekend, she was very, made a good effort at not using the word father.
Being inclusive.
But by the end of the weekend, through tiredness, I'm not sure what, she repeatedly kept slipping back into saying, the dads will do this. That was really tough. It felt quite alienating.
Did your partner find it?
Yeah, difficult? Really. She really hated it. Really hated it. Well, and she really didn't like being kind of lumped in with the dads.
No, she's going to be a mum.
She's going to be a mum.
I get that.
And she didn't particularly click with the men in the group. No. And most antenatal teaching is quite focused. Even if antenatal teachers are kind of aware of the fact that not everyone is the dad, father, yeah. You know, there is a lot of antenatal kind of NCT is all done like this, where there's lots of dad exercises and mum exercises. And even if the teacher says partner.
Are there any antenatal educational programs that focus on same-sex couples?
As far as I'm aware, no.
When are you going to start that, Amy?
As soon as this interview is finished. You know, as doulas, we kind of know that you can give oxytocin in a non-sexual way, you know, so...
Without a doubt.
At midwives, you know.
So that you've just talked about your first experience of pregnancy. Are you comfortable talking about your subsequent experience?
That relationship did finish, and we now co-parent, but in different homes. And after, you know, the usually tricky period when a long-term relationship ends, we get on really well. And with co-parenting in two homes is a good thing for us. And I now live with my current partner, who is a man. Yeah. So Lulu now has a kind of stepdad and a new stepmum. You know, for her... The family context is what is important. We were having a conversation, me and her friend and Lulu were kind of having a chat at the tea table, and her little friend was talking about how she was similar to her dad, how they looked similar and how they were similar. And I said to Lulu, "Oh, you might look like your donor." And she looked at me like, "What are you talking about?" The kind of genetic component of being like is totally over her head.
Could you just finish off by telling us where people can get in touch with you?
And I'll tell you a funny anecdote. So I was at a home birth group, you know, a lay kind of support group for families that are interested in home birth or had home birth. And I went there as a kind of, I'm just starting in my doula journey and I'm going to check this out and see what happens there. And met my first doula clients who were a lesbian couple. And they had that real, like, she walked in the room and saw me and said, I hope, in her head, I hope she's a doula. Because I want a doula and she's the one.
Wow, that's brilliant.
You know, she didn't know my story. She just saw me. So my very first clients were a lesbian couple. Wow. And it was very interesting me coming out to them. Because so they invited me to their house for our kind of, let's have a chat and see if we are going to work together. And I was, you know, like... wanting to be all good and doula boundaried, and this is not about me and my journey. And yet at the same time, like, thinking, what are the chances of that, you know? So my Facebook page, Amy Doula Services. My website is about to launch.
You're going to link to it on your Facebook page, though,
I am going to link to it on my Facebook page. And obviously, how most of my clients have found me has been through the Doula UK Find a Doula search.
If you were going to give some people some pointers, midwives in particular, when encountering a same-sex couple, what sort of pointers would you give from your own experience to a midwife and to a doula and to an antenatal teacher?
What's your language?
Yeah.
Really think of ways to be inclusive that don't just assume that the non-tummy mummy is just a kind of different version of the dad. Where, you know, think about and debrief your own prejudice and what your kind of thoughts and ideas are around what normal is and what family is and what makes a good family. And yeah, and really kind of be in that listening presence mode that is useful for all birth workers.
Hey, Amy, thanks for taking so long. I do appreciate
it. I also appreciate it very much.
That was interesting stuff. We've got quite a lot of other bits of news that aren't related to our core topic for today. So shall we have a quick chat about those?
Let's do the mandatory breastfeeding stuff.
Mandatory breastfeeding. Oh, right. I thought you meant... I was like, we're not making breastfeeding mandatory, Mark.
No, I meant I posted some derisory stuff about the House of Commons, talking about whether women who are, you know, MPs should be able to breastfeed in the Commons.
We've got the Guardian article, but it was all over the news, wasn't it? It's just on the 10th of November when several MPs were talking about this. Jess Phillips, the Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley, was asking for changes that would allow more women to be in politics, and that included bringing their children in when they're voting. And is it Alison Thewlis, the SNP MP? She's been asking for this for a long time. And who was the crazy old man who said that this would... Here we go, Simon Burns, Tory, surprise, surprise, MP for Chelmsford, felt that allowing breastfeeding in the House of Commons could invite ridicule from the tabloid press. And goodness me, that should be avoided at all costs, shouldn't it? We wouldn't like the press, we wouldn't like the media to be commenting or somehow... making some statement about what's going on in Parliament. Surely that's not their job.
As if we should be concerned about them. What did he say? When it's okay to do it at the supermarket checkout, it'll be okay here.
Well, it is okay to do it at the supermarket.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, and of course it's been going on in European Parliament for quite some time. An Italian, I think she's Italian, so I'm going to try and pronounce her name as Lika Ronzulli. Could be wrong, has been bringing her daughter to the European Parliament since she was a baby. She's had her in a sling. She's been there for all the votes.
Yeah, well, shouldn't we be looking to the House of Commons for leadership?
And the thing is that there's also this poll from Start for Life, which is part of the Department of Health, isn't it? That we've also got reported from Mid-Ears, and that's Facebook as well, showing that 21% of women prefer not to breastfeed in public. That's a lot of women.
How many?
21%.
It's no surprise, though, is it? Any breastfeeding story gets presented in a way that feels pejorative. You know, it feels like it's having a go.
Yeah, it does. They seem set out to divide us.
Without a doubt. I mean, that video is a point in question. Do you know, I posted that video about judgment on my Facebook page without watching it and without really investigating it.
Is that a Similac Mummy Wars?
Yes. Yeah. My mate Maddie pointed it out to me and I took it down. But it feels insidious. It feels Machiavellian. It feels very sophisticated in terms of communication techniques. The formula companies just know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. The whole breast is best mantra really plays so nicely into their theme, because they can't say that formula is best. So what they can say is breast milk is best. There's your aspirational target. Good luck with that, ladies. Or you could have, you know, this alternative. But obviously it's so much more complex than that. But
I know it is. And they are very good at it.
And this is a real lived experience. I hear this all the time. I had my first experience last week of doing an antenatal breastfeeding session in London. And what struck me, and it's the only one I've ever done there, so I don't know if this is a general theme, was that going around at the start, every single woman in the group expressed strong reservations about feeding in public. And I don't hear that much out here in the wilds of Berkshire.
Really?
I hear it, but not in the strong terms that I was hearing it in that group. And that may or may not be then connected to this other article we've got about 2 in 5 new parents experience mental health issues. It's the pressures that I'm making the connection with there.
I think that's a study from the RCN, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So it's a Guardian report, again on the 10th of November, from the Royal College of Nursing, finding that in a poll of 2,000 new mothers and fathers, less than half, 46% of those who suffer from anxiety, depression or another mental health issue considered seeking help from a healthcare professional. They're worried about stigma around mental health, and that seems to be a very big thing.
When my wife was diagnosed with cancer some 20 odd years ago, I was without a doubt suffering from clinical depression. And I remember the weight of anxiety that I woke up into every day, you know, where the normal functions of life seemed to be suspended. Life slowed down and became intolerable. And for a period of time, you know, I was on serotonin uptake inhibitors, and for me, they worked phenomenally well in giving me some kind of biophysical space to have new thoughts become available to me.
Yeah.
So I have some personal experience of depression and being treated for depression, you know.
And what led you to be treated, to seek support?
Well, I think it was having so many small children and feeling a sense of complete overwhelm.
Mm.
I think I was the last person to notice how irritated, snappy, probably, inverted commas, aggressive I was being with colleagues and friends and family. And eventually I got to the point where I needed help, and the GP was enormously supportive.
Yeah.
I started these serotonin uptake inhibitors, and after 2 weeks I was noticing a different physical feeling in my body. That knot in my chest disappeared.
Yeah.
Did a bit of gestalt therapy and general person-centered stuff, and it was the start of my journey into the other stuff that I've done, you know, self-relaxation, hypnosis, yeah. NLP.
So a combination of the meds and the therapies.
And for some people, talking therapies will be enough. I know
it's a difficult one to study, isn't it? But there is evidence, and I know how you feel about evidence, of positive outcomes from talking therapies.
Without a doubt. And CBT in the short to medium term does seem to be effective, nice as, you know, as validated yeah. it in that context. But the fairly new kid on the block, to a certain extent, mindfulness and awareness seems to be being talked about in very, very positive terms.
Oh, that's a really difficult one to research, though, isn't it?
Oh, you won't be able to. If you're looking for, inverted commas, gold standard randomized control.
I am, trial. Mark, I am.
Well, if you are, you know, you're not gonna come up with that.
How we're gonna have to look at, for me.
Well, we're gonna have to look at phenomenological methodology. You know,
you
we're gonna
can't
have
even
to,
say that.
I know, but you know what I mean? That the felt experience yes. of people. Like my mate Dennis says, if someone reads a narrative and it resonates with them, connects with their lived experience, there you've got generalizable research.
That's a very interesting thing.
The other thing about that RCN study, it was a study of 2,000
yeah.
folk, wasn't it? It was a poll, wasn't
yeah.
it? So, you know, all of those things are important to note.
Yes.
But something like 2/3 of the men in that study were not even asked about their mental health.
Well, yeah, when would they be asked? Who would ask them? I mean, it's yeah. all focused around the mother. And I know that's very important. She's very key to it, and she's gone through a lot of life changes, and she's the one who's off work, so she's there when the health visitor comes. But men have been through life changes too, with less support, with
yeah.
less understanding of their experience on a sort of professional basis. Yeah, somebody should be doing something about this, Mark.
There are people doing stuff. There's a number of Twitter feeds.
Mm.
Is it Mark Williams? In Wales, working with men who experience postnatal depression. There's also a guy in Wales who started a positive birth group for dads. I think it's the first positive birth group focused on dads in the country.
So just coming back to Mark Williams, his website is reachingoutpmh.co.uk.
Yeah, check him out.
And he's on Twitter as @fathersreaching.
He's a person who's had personal experience and feels very strongly that men need that support. And this poll does suggest that there's a need.
It really does, yes.
You know, just like the work that I'm doing at the moment, focusing on a man's experience of birth, lays a foundation for his experience of fatherhood. So those early months is laying a foundation for a family moving forward. And the impact that that has on children's forming brains and physiology, kind of, in a way, set a pathway for the rest of their lives. If men and women are experiencing these deep feelings of depression, anxiety, mental health issues, it creates an environment where a child who's modelling unconsciously the processes that the child sees around them then begin to take on patterns of behaving that will be with them for the rest of their lives until they have insight.
A real holistic view then of the importance of birth, the importance of fathers.
Yeah.
And then coming all the way back to the birth, so right in your remit now, we've got an article. It's on the Australian website, bellybelly.com.au, which is always quite useful on sciencey stuff. Okay, so we've got a study of 600 infants.
263 were included in the sample group for delay cord clamping. Some of them had 3 minutes delay, some had 10 seconds delay.
The assessments were IQ and cognitive tests, fine motor skills, and iron deficiency are all things that have been measured. Iron deficiency is something that we've long known as is related to cord clamping.
Yeah, maybe we can post some of the other more rigorous studies that have shown the benefits of delayed cord clamping to the point where I think it will soon be a nice guideline.
Is it not already? I just assumed that it was.
But if it isn't, it will be, because the studies are showing that it points to ongoing benefits to baby. This study in particular, you know, 263, 3 minutes and 10 seconds, it's interesting. It points to what I think we're beginning to feel is accepted, you know, practice parameter.
Yeah. I'm just having a quick look at NICE guidelines, and it's listed as a key priority for implementation.
Yeah, there you go.
We'd love to hear your views on all of this. Tell us what you think on facebook.com/sprogcast or Twitter @sprogcast. Now let's listen to our report from the third year student midwife Natalie, who was at the RCM conference last week.
Hello, this is Natalie Corden, student midwife. I'm just chatting with Karen today about the conference that I attended. That was the Royal College of Midwives conference, the annual conference in Telford a couple of weeks ago now. It was a great positive conference with midwives and student midwives. I'm a member of the Royal College of Midwives Student Midwife Forum. This is a forum that represents the United Kingdom with four student midwives from England, two from Scotland, two from Ireland and two from Wales. And we get together and talk about national and local issues, and we aim to sort of represent student midwives. We are the people that organise the student conference, in that we discuss what things we think are current and topics that students might be interested in. We chose this year to focus on continuity and also record keeping, as well as looking at normality in the context of social media.
That sounds really interesting stuff. And was it well attended?
It was really well attended. Apparently it was the best conference attendance ever by student midwives this year, which we're really sort of proud of. There was really positive feedback. It was a great day. Fantastic.
Congratulations. Sounds like you must have worked quite hard to set that all up.
It's a work in progress. It takes obviously like a year to decide on what we're going to do and go about asking people if they'd like to come along and speak. Luckily, we had some, you know, really great speakers, including Dennis Walsh and the wonderful Jenny Clark, who came to speak about skin to skin, which the students really, really loved that, really sort of engaged with her. And also sort of innovations in practice, which was really good as well.
Great speakers.
Yes, really great. And the main conference, which the midwives and student midwives all gathered together. So in the room, there was probably nearly 1,000 people there. You know, we were all there to begin with at the beginning of the conference. And we had the wonderful Karen Gilliland. She is the chief exec of the New Zealand College of Midwives. It was a very motivational address, talking about how, you know, the New Zealand midwives have challenged the government in New Zealand to take control of their own profession, responsibility for the professional standards and the quality of care that they deliver. So you can imagine a room full of midwives, you know, standing up and saying, yes, you know, that's what we want in this country. So it was great. We had a hashtag this year of proud to be.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, it was a fantastic hashtag, wasn't it? It was shared all over Twitter, which was really good. And we all had it and we all stood up and held it. A little banner saying proud to be, which, you know, it was a great moment.
Who did you meet?
As the RCM SMF, we had sort of meeting meetings up with the board of the RCM. So we had an opportunity to speak to Leslie Page, the chief executive, and we had chats with Sheena Byram, the lovely Sheena Byram, and Amanda Burley, who's just taken her place on the board, which is really interesting to talk to her because she's been campaigning for optimal cord clamping for a long time now, and that's really sort of seemed to have taken off, on Twitter and across the board with the new nice edge part and guidelines.
Yeah, big names there, and the cord clamping is something that Mark and I have been discussing as well. So what was the absolute highlight for you?
Can I be cheeky and say seeing Leslie Page and Kathy Warwick do the conga at the park? It was great to see like the real human side of people,
yeah,
and see that we are all sort of humans and we're all trying to do the best that we can and provide, you know, the best, you know, high quality care, safe care that we can, but also that we are all humans and that we all do need to have a little bit of party time sometimes, you know, we do need to sort of relax and chill out. And it was great to see sort of like the chief exec and the president doing that,
yeah,
you know. I suppose on a professional level, the highlight was sort of being there and sort of being with the student midwife forum and being hosting and being part of that was a great highlight.
And so will you be going again next year as a qualified midwife?
I will be qualified, but I'll still be standing in my little student spot because I'll still be planning the conference for next year because I still have the role until I qualify. So I'll be there, but I will be qualified.
You're so busy.
Yeah.
How do you manage?
I think it's just because I'm so motivated.
Yeah.
I'm so motivated. I've got so much enthusiasm and energy for what I want to do. And it adds to it. I think the more, you know, this year, the more positive I've been about things, the more things have come to me. So, like, you know, things are coming and I sort of accept that and you know, they make things better. Yeah, that's why I keep doing what I'm doing.
Good. And you'll keep talking to us, won't you?
I will keep talking to
you.
Thank you. Yes.
It's really nice to chat to you. Thanks, Natalie.
No problem. Thanks. Bye.
Last episode, we did a few book reviews, but we thought we would try something different this time and each of us endorse something we've enjoyed lately. So, Mark, what have you got to endorse?
Well, it's still a book. It's a book called Prometheus Rising by Anton Wilson. And I read a lot of books, Karen. This book I've read five, maybe six times. And it's not a birth book, but it's a book about how we get imprinted, if you like, at very young age. And it's about how we can work to uncover those imprinting influences to the point where we can actually begin to see clearly. You know, the reason I think the book is so powerful for me is that I, like every human being, get stuck in a dogmatic way of seeing the world and not just the world, but every issue. So, and just recently I've been a bit disheartened when I see the level of vitriol in the birth community when people express polarized opinions. Mm-hmm. And I really think there's another way. And this book points to it. A book that has influenced my life profoundly. What about you?
I want to endorse an antenatal group facilitation activity that I pulled out of a book called Birth Skills by Juju Sundin with Sarah Murdoch, which I had lying around on my shelf for ages, and then I needed an activity, a sort of birth visualization distraction or something like that for a study day I was doing. I flicked through and I found this, and it seemed really good, and I tried it with a group, and then I took it to the study day, and the antenatal teachers really kind of picked it up and ran with it. And it's about walking together. And it's suggesting that as a sort of practiced distraction technique, so a bit like a hypnobirthing skill where you've got to practice it to really find it useful at the time when you're in labour. So sitting with your partner or lying with your partner in a nice, comfortable environment, nice music, close your eyes, have a hug, that sort of thing. Yeah. And then the birth partner takes you on a walk in your mind. And in the book, it suggests a walk around the streets near your home, and you'd like go out the door, see the gate, go through the gate and walk down the street, and what do you see, what's the weather like, and then, and you talk for 30 seconds and then you stop for 30 seconds and just rest for a bit. And on the study day, we kind of developed that to be, firstly, you could extend it and say, it's a walk around somewhere that's special to you.
Yeah.
Or somewhere that you've been together, or somewhere that you would imagine taking your baby in the very near future. And also something that you could do, for example, while you're waiting for induction to work.
Right.
When you're going in the next morning for a planned cesarean and you're wanting to kind of experience some of this oxytocin increasing, natural oxytocin increasing activities that, that are going to just ease that process of attachment with your baby. It just seemed like a really nice thing. I had the final session of my current NCT Essentials course last night, and I did it as the last or the second to last thing, and it was just a really peaceful, pleasant way to end.
It sounds wonderful. It reminds me of mindfulness work, you know, that kind of a mindful walk.
Yeah, I suppose it is, isn't it? We've got a breaking news section on Sprogcast today, because now, as we're recording on the 25th of November, there has been a news article about weekends being associated with a higher rate of complications for births in hospitals in England. Now, have you heard anything about this on the news, Mark, or have you been living on under a rock today?
I mean, I've been under a rock until you sent me an email about it. And then I had a quick look at it, and then I immediately jumped into Russell Brand conspiracy mode.
Did you? Well, that's interesting.
Isn't it surprising that this comes public now, in the middle of a discussion with junior doctors about ours?
And strikes and what have you. I thought that too, and I know that Sprogcast is probably getting a bit of a reputation for being terribly cynical about every piece of research we ever discuss.
I don't think it's cynical. I am never, Karen, going to come to the conclusion that this research or any research proves anything conclusively.
Right. So it's a BMJ article. You can find it online, and I've posted it on Facebook. Its title is Association Between Day of Delivery and Obstetric Outcomes, Observational Study. And the authors are looking at a few different outcomes, but of course the one that has been widely reported is the increase, apparent increase, in perinatal mortality where babies are born on a Saturday or a Sunday. So they also looked at perineal tears, puerperal infection, maternal readmission, injury to the baby, selected infections for the baby, and neonatal readmissions. Right. And they've compared everything with Tuesday. So Tuesday's their baseline.
Right.
And, as far as perinatal mortality is concerned, every day but Tuesday is a bad day to be born.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm looking at the table where it shows Tuesday as the baseline and a higher risk on every other day. Thursdays actually seem to be much more dangerous than weekends.
What about the other outcomes?
The other things they looked at. So. Yeah. Perineal tears, same every day. Doesn't matter what day you have your baby, you're still as likely or not to tear.
Right.
Puerperal infection does go up slightly on a Saturday, but I'm looking at tables with confidence intervals, yeah, and the lines overlap pretty much entirely.
Right.
So you can't really say that's statistically significant.
No.
Maternal readmissions actually go down at the weekend. Neonatal injury, lowest on a Wednesday and Thursday, highest on a Sunday.
Right.
Which I'm sure could be interestingly unpicked. Neonatal infections, it seems a bit random, but again, the lines all cross.
See, I can imagine some people would hear the readmissions on a Sunday, on the weekend being lower. Is that right?
Yes.
I could imagine people jump to conclusions about that being related to doctor availability.
It could be.
You know, if a GP is trying to get hold of a hospital doctor at the weekend, you know, they may be more inclined not to want to readmit at the weekend because they know about the resource challenges. Go on.
A mother could go to a GP during the week and the GP reassure her, whereas at the weekend, isn't she more likely to go to A&E, where an A&E doctor will err on the side of caution and readmit them?
I think we can cut these results to suit our prejudice.
Yes, I think so too. I also had a look at the table that had the actual rates on, which was really interesting. But it shows, looking now at the perinatal mortality, a rate of 0.65%, which I had a chat with my friend who's a scientist, and she knew about statistics and numbers, and she helped me translate this into 6.5 deaths per 1,000 on a weekday and 7.1 deaths per 1,000 at the weekend. So it's less than one extra baby.
Yeah, I you know, and we always, when we're looking at statistics, we have deep compassion for those small numbers that fall into that category, right?
Yes, thank you for saying that.
You know, our heart bleeds for them, and it shouldn't happen to anyone. But zero risk in our world is an impossibility. I think the community at large is being subject to spin in terms of how it's been reported. And not very subtle, if you ask me.
Indeed. And I heard the representative of the RCOG, and I know how much we love the RCOG and their famous saying, but he was very sensible, and he did point out that if you are admitted to hospital and sadly your baby is stillborn on a Sunday, the baby probably died earlier in the week.
Yeah, good point. Sorry, it's a harsh point, but it's a good point. Being able to see the bigger picture, it's the way, you know, when you're critiquing any research article, you know, one of the first questions you ask is who wrote it?
And where did the money come from?
And, you know, when you think about the timing of this.
Well, yes, and that's very clear from the fact that immediately on the news they were talking about increasing consultants' hours, making consultants more available at the weekend, et cetera, et cetera. So from the press release that came with this, it says no association was found between consultant staffing levels and complications such as perinatal death or injuries to the baby during birth.
Very interesting.
So we're not going to dismiss this, but
this is existing in its publication in a broader political context. I can't avoid seeing that. And when you drill down into the data specifically, as you have done with your 0.65, you begin to see the relative risk quite clearly, don't you?
As usual, the mainstream media is full of, you know, increased risk. What must that mean for women, you know, who are expecting their baby very, very soon and are thinking, oh, my God, what if I go into labour on Friday night?
Yeah. Can you give a potted definition of the difference between absolute risk and relative risk? So, for example, my chicken joke, 33% lived, 33% died, and the other bugger got away. That's drawing the distinction between the relative risk, which is percentage, and the absolute risk, which is the actual numbers.
Yes. Yeah, so, and the absolute risk then is the risk of something happening, and the relative risk is a comparison of the risk in two different groups. But we've got the 0.65 on a Tuesday compared with 0.71 at the weekend. So relatively, weekend has a higher death rate. But absolutely, we're still talking about a risk that is very, very low.
Good.
And that's all for this episode of Sprogcast. We hope you'll join us for the next one, which is going to be about sleep, almost certainly. I know we've been promising that for several episodes. It's been hard to get hold of the right people. If you have any suggestions or comments, do get in touch via Facebook or Twitter.
That's facebook.com/Sprogcast and at Sprogcast on Twitter. We love doing it, but we love hearing from you.
So I have to say, Mark, and I'm going to interrupt you, that there's a lot of people out there who will empathise with the fact that I do Sprogcast because it's nice to sit and talk to you for an hour.
Knowing that the stuff we're doing is connecting with people is quite important to us, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Right, thanks for listening, and goodbye for another episode.
Bye then.
You've been listening to Sprogcast with Mark Harris and Karen Hall. Editing and production is by Karen, with technical assistance from Pete. Find us on facebook.com/Sprogcast.